funcionarios.
Sin usted, sin la, perdón, sin momento, la presión de ustedes, sin la presión de ustedes aquí afuera, sin la, los aplausos que ustedes hicieron mientras estamos discutiendo, sin los gritos que ustedes dieron, mientras nosotros estamos discutiendo, nosotros no hubiéramos podido llegar a estos acuerdos.
Sí, pero un funcionario del Ministerio de Cultura.
Something unusual and even a little hopeful happened in Havana this weekend. That audio you just heard, recorded by Reuters journalist Sarah Marsh, was from a rare public protest outside of the Culture Ministry building. The people speaking and clapping and singing actually forced the Cuban government into dialogue about censorship in the country. Now, who knows where things will go from there, but I know this. Cuba, for all of its moldering beauty for the outsider, should scare us all. Not just because its regime is so cynical and self-aware enough of its own rot that it actually punishes people by preventing them from leaving their country. No, it should scare us also because of people here in the United States, people who hate the press as much as any Cuban functionary. Our outgoing administration rails against socialism while trying to create their own de facto state news channels and publicly intimidating and discrediting any media that doesn't go along with them. It is a perfect blueprint for running a country like a Castro. But maybe, just maybe, better traditions will win out, both in the US and in Cuba. Independent journalism has flourished on the island in the past 5 years, at great risk, but with a protozoic zeal for truth and real reporting. Today's guest sat down with me on a warm Havana morning just before COVID locked the world down. Her name is Monica Barreau, and she is an independent journalist at the vanguard of this movement, reporting the truth in a country that denies its own facts and doing so at great personal risk. It is enough to make you want to sit in and clap and sing and fight the good fight just like her wherever you live. This is Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, you're listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world. What are we drinking here?
Bad coffee. Oh,
that's so harsh. It's not the coffee's fault. It's that I got you an Americano, and you gave me a look as like, am I an American? Why is there water in my espresso?
Where's my coffee? This is not coffee.
But you like the coffee spot. This is a favorite spot of yours, right? Cuba
yes.
Libre. Why?
It's the only place here in Havana that allows you to be there doing whatever you want, the time you want, without buying anything. So it's very good, and it's very peaceful too. I like the environment there, the people that go there, and also the service there. It's yeah. very nice, and it's very quiet.
A lot of places here are like more transactional. Like, how much money are we making off of you sitting here?
Exactly, yeah. exactly. And that place, not about that. There's a community around Cuba Libre. Actually, Cuba Libre is run by an American. It's a woman from New York.
That is true.
Yes.
She was hanging out there
perhaps,
today.
Perhaps that's the reason.
See, look at that. So Americano's not so bad after all. I feel like a local already. I've like had two meetings set up over there, just hanging out, meeting people. All right, Cuba Libre, that's our plug for the day. We're drinking this coffee, which, by the way, I like their coffee. It's just, you're just objecting to the water.
Yes, for being an American, it's nice. Yes.
Americanos are my jam. It must be a thing of birth. You were born in Havana?
Here in Havana, right.
How common is that? How many people are from the provinces, and how many people are like Habaneros?
Well, actually, in Havana, there are a lot of people who are not from Havana, especially professionals, because in other cities or provinces of the country, it's very hard to develop a profession. Most of the research centers are here in Havana, most of educational centers are here in Havana. The best opportunities are here in Havana. So it's hard for you if you are a professional to be in Havana. If you're a dancer, if you are a painter, anything is better always in Havana for getting a job.
That's a very positive way of putting it. A friend of mine said something like, you think things are fucked in Havana, you should see the provinces.
Exactly. This is like New York.
Yeah, right.
In comparison with other provinces of the country, yes.
Right. So the hustle, the struggle to like get by, to have nice things, to mm-hmm. have an easier way of life, it all leads to
Havana. Yeah, most of the cinemas are here. In the other provinces, there are no cinemas. So that's only a signal of how different are the other provinces of Havana.
Have you been around Cuba much?
Yes, not too much as I wish, but I've been working most of the time. I've been in other provinces reporting, and I've been able of knowing how different life is in other places. For example, in Santiago de Cuba, Guantanamo is especially different from Havana. It's like another country. It's going to another country. It's quite different and quite poor.
Yeah.
But even the poverty is very different of the poverty that you find here in Havana. And sometimes you think that when you go to a community, a rural community and in the country, you think that perhaps because they don't want the things that you have, you think that they are poor people. But sometimes they don't need the same things that you need. And the concept of what it's poverty changes a lot. And of course, you have to be careful because sometimes you could go there with a romantic vision of, oh, they are not poor people, they are just spiritual persons.
They're living off the land.
Yes, yeah. And that's not the whole truth. And you have to be able of distinguishing the differences. But it's very poor. And so you have an idea, if you want to have an idea of how poor are people in the other sides of the country, most of the illegal communities here in Havana, which are built with anything, the name in Spanish is Yegibon, that is actually like arrive and put it. It's uh-huh. like you get to a place and make your home with anything, with goods, with things that you find in the garbage, with things that no one wants, and they build their homes like that, especially wooden homes.
Like shanty towns.
Very poor, yeah. And without electricity, without sanitary conditions, vulnerable to many disasters, and they rather to be here in that conditions than being in their provinces. They are, some of them even living in buildings that are closed because they are falling apart, and they try to expose themselves to die in a collapse that being in their provinces. So the poverty is very hard in other parts of the country.
That's why, and they're not necessarily allowed to be here. They just come for the opportunity or something.
Exactly. There's no an immigration policy.
Like internal migration
exactly,
is
internal.
Outlawed generally?
No, it's not allowed. Most of the people have to find like strategies for staying here in Havana legally, but most of them are not legal, and all the times they are sent back to their provinces, the authorities can stop you in the street and ask your identification. If you are not from Havana, they could send you back to your province. So that's, imagine if you cannot be in the capital of your country because you could be sent back to your hometown.
You could be deported.
Exactly, yeah. In your own country.
In your own country. Well, that's, I guess, another sign of how eager people are here to come here, is they just will undertake that risk also, being stopped.
Exactly.
And sent back to Pinar del Rio, wherever. Okay, how did you get into journalism?
Oh...
it sounds like a bit of regret in that sigh. We can examine that also, but let's start with just the facts. How did this?
We were talking about it. So how? That's a big question. Well, I started writing. I'm a person who tells stories. That's what I am, And I write since I was 10 years old, more or less. And I decided to study journalism because I didn't have too many options once I finished my bachelor. No, bachelor is like a high school, but it's not actually high school because it's like a technical degree or something like that. In my time, there was no high school in the cities, so I didn't want to go to the countryside to study. So I decided to do like a technical study, something like that.
After, so you got a technical degree in languages?
In accountability.
Accountability?
Exactly.
You mean accounting? Like numbers?
Yes, numbers.
Okay.
Yes. And when I finished there, I had to try to get to the university with a special test that were like a contest. So a lot of people under 25 goes to that kind of test if they want to go to the university, but that's not the regular way to the university because you are competing with a lot of people at the same time. And journalism was a very easy career because, in a way, because they had or they still have a special test, so you had to do. Or you have to do a general culture test and also a test that is for writing, for showing your abilities to write, and another one that is an interview. And for me, it was like a very easy to face that test, or I thought that. And well, it results that I was selected at the end, and that's how I end up in journalism, at least in the career. Because I had a second time in my life when I decided to do journalism, because I decided in that time to study journalism because I wanted to have a degree, a university degree.
Any kind of degree.
Any kind of degree. For me, it was like, I don't know, it wasn't a way to make happy to my fathers and to my parents. And
did they have university degrees?
Yes.
They expected that of you.
Yes, they expected that. And it was not an imposition, but I wanted them to feel I want them to feel proud of me, and for me it was important to do that. I wanted also to do that. It was not a huge thing for me or a sacrifice. I didn't have to sacrifice anything for studying journalism, and it was something that I just wanted to do, but I didn't know that I wanted to be a journalist.
Yeah, what did you think of journalism? Like, did you have role models, or you were not really thinking about it?
I only
much?
Think that I could write. If I'm a journalist, I will write, and it's fine if I can write. Of course, in the career, it was completely different. And when I graduated from the university, I didn't want to write anything. For me, it was very frustrating, the whole career, because the education here in Cuba is very, 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 very violent in a way, and it's very old, and it's very, I don't know, it's not focused in making a more creative person or making you like a free person. Is focused in make you in teach you how to reproduce something.
Yeah,
that's annoying.
Yeah, I remember this about Cuba for all of its, you know, sort of claims of being a revolutionary society. Certainly in education. I mean, all of my friends who were musicians had to go to La Haina and play in symphonies. You know,
exactly.
And their hearts were always beating with, you know, with salsa or son or charanga, but they had to be playing Brahms, you know.
Exactly.
I imagine it's something like that in the university course for journalism.
It's the same. It's exactly the same. So I had to leave a discovery of journalism after I graduated. And that discovery started when I became an independent journalist. I had the idea that I wanted to tell stories. I wanted to do journalism, but I didn't have the opportunity of living what was being a journalist. Because when I finished university, I was in a state magazine during almost 2 years. And after that, of course, it was a very frustrating experience too, because I didn't feel proud of what I was writing, and no one recognized my job or even the magazine at all.
What was it called?
Bohemia.
Bohemia.
Bohemia, which is the oldest magazine in Latin America. It was found in 1908.
Wow.
Yes, it's a very old magazine. In the 40s and the 50s, it was a very good magazine, but... Well, after 1959, everything changed here.
And it got, and it's now a government magazine that's not in the business of saying interesting things or making stars of its writers.
Not in the business of making journalism at all.
Yeah.
Only propaganda. So,
how many years were you there?
Almost 2 years.
Did you learn anything from there?
Yes, of course. I learned that I didn't want to do that kind of journalism.
that is the best on-the-job learning you can do. I learned I don't want to do this.
Exactly.
What more can you ask from a job? God bless Bohemia and all of its lessons for you.
Exactly. And after that, I had a similar experience because I was in a research center of philosophy. And I was working with local governments as a researcher. And trying to collaborate and to develop process of participation, democratic process for changing things in their communities. But then I realized that I was there thinking as a journalist. I didn't want to make any advice. I didn't want to coordinate any process. I wanted to tell the problems to everybody.
That is a very nice distillation of what journalists do.
Yes.
I want to shout about some problems. Is that too much to ask? Okay.
Yes.
So then you took off, and is that when you decided independent journalism?
Yes. At that time, I in my reality, I didn't find like a project which I could feel identified. And in that moment, specifically, Periodismo de Barrio came out as a project, the announce of Elaine Diaz, which is the director right now, of this project, and she was asking people to participate, to apply to the job.
So the name means neighborhood journalism?
Exactly, it's like community journalism.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not because they are making journalism from communities, but the point of view that the media assumes. Because in the state media, most of the time, the stories are told from the official sources' point of view. So the perspective in Periodismo de Barrio was to tell the stories from the people's points of view.
And this was a non-aligned, I assume, non-government connected project?
No, it was independent, completely independent.
That's dangerous.
Yes, it was one of the first independent projects that came out after 14 y medio. But 14 y medio was a newspaper, especially a newspaper. And it was a result of the experience of Joanny Sánchez as a blogger. So Periodismo de Barrio, it came from a different experience because Elaine Díaz was a professor in the university, was also a blogger, an important blogger at the same time of Joanny Sánchez. And she was an Iman Fellow in Harvard.
Uh-huh.
And after ending her time in Harvard, in the Iman Fellowship, she came back and founded this project, Periodismo de Barrio. Was like the result of the fellowship.
What year are we talking about?
That was in 2016.
2016. All right. I'll let you go ahead and have another sip of the coffee. One of the great things about Americanos is you have more liquid, there's just more to drink. What an invention.
No, sorry, 2015 was...
2015.
October 2015 was the first time we published.
She came back from the Nieman Fellowship at Harvard to start this project, which...
Exactly.
Is you know, takes what we would call chutzpah. You know, it's a... as someone who got arrested in Cuba, in part thanks to the authorities' distaste for Joanny Sánchez, like... I feel the risk of this endeavor like pretty strongly. How were you nervous?
I don't think on that. You can't be here doing independent journalism and thinking on that all the time. Of course, I'm conscious about that, about the risks that I'm assuming all the time. But when I do my job, I try to focus on my job. I don't like to have distractions. And you have to be prepared. I'm prepared for anything, for going to jail, for being arrested, for being regulated, which means that you are not allowed to travel abroad. And I live prepared in a way, all you can be for this kind of situations that are very weird. And
does that mean like always having a bag ready to go?
That means to have a security security protocol. A security protocol, and that means to be to have your information in safe places. That means that you have networks for denouncing any kind of harassment or violence that you suffer. That means that you know what to do if something goes wrong immediately. You know how to react. I think that that means that I have thought in that. But I'm not thinking in that. I had the time to think in that. So when I have to work, I focus on my work.
And you're not always nagged by unfinished business or maybe not being prepared.
No, there's nothing like it. It's not intelligent because there's nothing you can do for avoiding that. It's like start thinking about that. You can die anytime. There's danger all the time, but you don't think that because it's not useful. There's nothing you can do for preventing life to happen. Life is going to happen.
And death, taxes, and possible arrest by the subjugating authorities.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Got your happy price, Priceline.
What I'm doing is illegal. There are a lot of felonies that I'm committing as an independent journalist. It's completely illegal. Yes. Yes, with 20 years of jail, something like that.
That's amazing.
Yes.
I would have suspected that the laws were not so naked, maybe, that it was more just the practice of repressing independent journalism, but there's actually laws against, is like very specific statutes.
The penal code actually has, the Constitution first doesn't recognize the independent journalists because they say that the only media that has the right to exist is the media who are ruled by the state, which are the media who belongs also to the party, in a way. And you are out of the Constitution just for starting, no? And when you go to the penal code, you find that there are a lot of articles there that you are violating all the time. For example, tax evasion.
Mm.
That could be one because I don't pay anything. I don't pay taxes for my incomes because my profession is not recognized. So I'm not paying any taxes to the society.
You can't even declare your income because
my job doesn't exist.
Wow.
Exactly. So there's another figure here in Cuba that is very, very, very special. That is a dangerous state. That so if someone is vulnerable to commit a crime, just like in Minority Report in the movie, could go to jail for 1 year or 2 years.
Just for a thought crime.
Yes, because the authorities think that you are able of committing a crime because, for example, if you don't have a job, a regular job, you are seen like a person that is capable of committing a crime. So they could use the dangerous state for or dangerous condition for put you in jail. So only with that figure, they could put you in jail. And there's also another law, a very important law. The name is, well, the number is 88 law. That is related with the embargo from the US, and it says that any journalist that or person that publish something that in a way give reasons to the US or the enemy to sustain the embargo could go to jail. And that was the law that they used, the government used in 2003 during the Black Spring, when 75 person went to jail for doing journalism or any kind of activist.
How deeply is this podcast episode violating Law 88?
Well, if you are not here like a journalist, and if you didn't go to the International Press Center or something like that in English,
yeah,
probably you are doing something illegal.
Yeah. Well, this is why I got arrested last time I was arrested here.
Yes.
But what the fuck? I mean, they won't give you permission.
No.
So why ask? I mean, to be honest, like that's why I didn't. I think that's why I got arrested last time, was because
probably
one, we had done something at Time Magazine with Ioanni, but two, I applied for a journalist visa, so they knew I was coming. They just never got back to me. They were just like, "Thanks for the application. If you do show up, we're going to arrest you." So
exactly.
Now you know it's just a profoundly different experience to face that as an American who gets to go home. So I don't want to compare our experiences. You know, the risk that you put yourself in, you know, and your colleagues is a very different form and style and gravity. Is the work that you do worth it?
Yes, I believe so. I'm not... There are a lot of journalists that are asking all the time, what's the meaning of what I do if nothing changed? I'm not that kind of journalist. I think that my job is to denounce what's wrong in my society, and the work of activists and the society and politicians is to fix it. And I think I do my job. And if everybody do their jobs, the society were better in a way. And I'm glad, I feel fine with myself, knowing that I do my best and I do my job. And if in the future all these projects die because the conditions are very aggressive, I think that we already make an important statement. We show to the government that we are able to do journalism, a quality journalism, without supervision of the Communist Party. And that's important. We show that not only to the government, but also to a lot of people, and even to a lot of people outside Cuba that perhaps thought that there was nothing in Cuba important to see regarding to independent journalists or regarding to journalism at all. And in the last 5 years, a lot of independent projects has received a lot of recognitions from international prizes and from different centers, academies, and other media. And that's important. We show that there's talent in Cuba for doing journalism, for doing even journalism in such hard conditions. And we showed to the government that we don't need them to know what's right and what's wrong in journalism.
So in part of being outside the system is you also have to maintain your own set of standards and your own sort of ethical way of doing journalism. Is that training process of training independent journalists in not just being against the state, but being objective, right? And being fact-based, is that how much is educating other journalists and yourself in that model a part of what you do?
Well, a lot of journalists that are working in independent projects right now came out from universities, from the career of journalism. And we had like basic ideas of what journalism was. But was when we started to do journalism, when we realized that there was a long way and a very big zone that was very unknown for us. And that took a lot of discussions, for example, first in Periodismo de Barrio when I was, and that takes still a lot of discussions because there are huge differences between the different independent magazines and newspapers that are now in Cuba working. But I think that we are trying to, in a way, to read and to study how other magazines or newspapers in the world has faced these problems, these conflicts, and to adapt those ideas and those codes and those standards to our conditions. One of the things that for me is very important is that not because you are in a society where there's no press freedom, you are allowed to be messy or irresponsible with your job. You have to be very precise and very rigorous all the time. It doesn't matter if there's no access to sources, there's no reason for being a bad journalist. You have to follow the rules and you have to make a journalism like if you were in a society with press freedom.
What do you think the average Cuban thinks about journalism and what it can do for their lives?
That's hard. I think that when I started to do independent journalism in 2015, most of the people were afraid of what the independent journalism was. I didn't recognize myself as an independent journalist because that's like a bad word here in Cuba. Everything that is independent is a bad word. Even democracy is a bad word. Human rights is a bad word. And everything is related with the enemy. Mm. Those are ideas of the enemy. And in the beginning, I realized that there was a lot of people afraid of what the independent journalism meant. But right now, in 2020, that has changed a lot. And you find people who write to you to ask you to tell their stories. And I think that, in a way, that's a result of the reputation that we have built, not only in the magazines where I've been working, but in all the independent media in general. And people realize that we are allies, especially people who are suffering injustice and who want something to tell. But still it's hard because sometimes you have to make an educational job. You have to explain people what does it mean to give a statement, to give an interview, to tell a story. And imagine how is a society where we have been living without press freedom for 60 years of expression freedom.
Yeah.
That's something most of the people here have grown up without knowing what is press freedom, or without knowing what is diversity, or without knowing what is association freedom. So you have to be conscious that there are a lot of ignorance, a lot of
prejudice.
And you have sometimes to work with that, and you get to a community. For foreign journalists, it's very hard to understand that. Even for journalists who are dealing with Cuba outside Cuba, that's very hard, because sometimes you cannot make an interview in the first time. You only have to get to the community and sit with someone and start talking about anything, but you cannot get to some place in a hurry and make a question suddenly. You have to go there and try to get to know the people and being, I don't know, relax and get the people the opportunity to meet you. And it's a very slow process.
Well, it's possible that that's good journalism practice anyway, but it's a pain in the ass when you're on deadline.
And exactly, yes.
You might not feel like you have an afternoon to just sit and get comfortable. I've had some experiences with just being almost sort of denounced by people here when I'm trying to work as a journalist, or when I have even people I know, just when I came back as a journalist, having just saying like, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know what your publication is up to. I don't know what, you know, these are people who I love, but I think they're in their head is really, really danger, like warning signs going off, you know, that international media is kind of out to get them.
Yes, that's the enemy.
It is
the enemy. You're an enemy.
It is an enemy. That's so crazy. Yes. But so you have to deal with that. Where are you publishing these days? So you started with community journalism. Where do you publish your work?
Right now, I'm working for El Estornudo, but I collaborate with different media, with another one that the name is Toca, that it could be like the Toche or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And
these are all digital publications?
Yes, independent media.
Independent
digital
media.
Of course, because we cannot print.
Nobody would give you permission to print what you do.
No, that's like... if you want to go to jail, you should print what you're publishing.
Excellent. Let's make a plan to go to jail. We'll print out this podcast and hand it out on the street corners.
Exactly.
It's interesting. I mean, it's like Russia, where you can actually exist in independent media as long as you stay away from television. That's their like no-go zone, you know, because they know television kind of controls the Russian mind. Is there any video or television journalism that you would qualify or classify as independent here?
No television. Well, there are people who make video, but only online. No, it's not broadcasted.
Only for Facebook or...
Facebook, YouTube, or just in the same platforms of the media.
How do these publications make money?
Well, most of them live with grants, international grants from different organizations. It depends on the publication. For example, Periodismo de Barrio, which is the only one that has a transparency policy regarding financement, receive money from the Swedish Foundation of Human Rights, which works here with organizations that belongs to the government. That's the only one that works with an independent organization and at the same time with an organization of the government. The other one is Open Society, which also gives money to El Estornudo. And the other one, in the case of El Estornudo, not in the case of Periodismo de Barrio, is National Endowment for Democracy, which is a very controversial organization. But the problem with the independent magazine here is that most of the international NGOs that already work with the government, with the state, with any organization or project of the state, are not allowed to work at the same time with independent organizations. That restricts a lot your opportunities to get access to finance sources.
This is kind of a deal they have to make with the government. You want to be involved, you want to be connected, you have to stay away from independent media.
Exactly. Independent media and any project who is independent from the government, any kind of project, even if you have a project focused in the community and in the natural disasters or, I don't know, a trash challenge, anything. The problem here is that you cannot be independent from the state. The state have to control everything.
Well, let's since we're breaking some laws, let's dive right into more law breaking. Tell me, what is the biggest problem in Cuba? Like, what is keeping this country back?
In my opinion, it's the lack of freedoms. It's not the embargo. It's not that we are a poor country. It's the lack of freedoms. And The government is being very arrogant. A lot of young people are leaving the country. A lot of capable people, a lot of talented people. And that's something that you cannot get back. That loss is something that you cannot measure how long you will take to recovering from something like that. And the government is only worried about keeping the power in all directions. For me, that's the biggest problem here in Cuba.
The brain drain is enormous. And I mean, nobody knows how many people have even just died trying to leave this country, which is insane. But a sign that people who just see opportunity is not something that's going to come here in Cuba is enormous. How do you, as a, you know, free press loving journalist, stay in Cuba? I mean, you could go practice, you know, journalism freely in so many places.
I love to do journalism here. Of course, everyone who lives in Cuba has thought about leaving the country. It's not possible that you find someone here without thinking on that at some point in their lives. But I love the stories that I tell here, and I love the reality, even with so many problems. And I think that we have sometimes to get away for a while. Actually, right now I applied for a fellowship, but only for living for a few period of time, only a year. I wouldn't like to be away from my job more than that. And
is that in the States or in Europe?
Yes, in the US. And because you need to see your country, to think your reality from far, from the distance, because this is a very weird reality, and you have to keep in mind that the world is not like that.
Yeah,
this is no normal at all.
Monica is absolutely right. It's very fucking strange here.
Yeah,
but I can imagine just growing up in this system, you do kind of get used to, you know, whether you're opposed to it or agree with it, it's still your reality.
And it's not that like the other realities are better or worse. It's not that. They are like more normal realities. And normal even with problems. Normal, it doesn't mean that they don't have problems. They do have problems, but the time is different, the problems are faced in a different way, and it's important for people who are working here under so much stress in order to keep their mental peace that they be able of leaving the country for a while and coming back. That's very important, very important.
Well, without naming names, when you arrived here today, you were kind of in a fluster because there's someone in your community who's facing the possibility of restrictions. This is a common thing, a common threat, is restrictions against travel, possibly, right? That they might keep journalists from leaving the island as punishment. Is that a tactic of the state?
Yes, there are a lot of, I don't know the exact number right now, but there are more than 100 journalists who are regulated, who cannot leave the country. And only in these days, in the past few days, I had two friends, very, very close friends, who were called by the authorities for facing interrogations. Is that the right word?
Yeah, I mean, it could
for
be.
Facing, yes.
They basically bring them in for questioning.
Exactly, exactly. And they are asking all the time about their troubles, about their job. And one of the friends that were called by the authorities was even threats. It received many threats about his own security and because of the work that he does. And that's something that is all the time, very common, all the time is happening.
Were they threatening security in a way of saying like, hey, we can't protect you if something bad happens, or is it a more...
They have threat journalists who have kids with their kids. They have talk about, hey, I know where your kids play. Hey, I know that your kid is sick right now. Be careful. I know that your wife is pregnant. So you shouldn't be like this because you want her to receive a good attention. And there are like a lot of subtle threats. And this one with kids, with people who have kids. There's the other one with journalists because they want you to leave the country. That's like the strategy. They don't kill you, but they want you to quit what you're doing, or to leave the country. That's in a way the way they define to silence you, and they don't want a scandal of putting you in jail. They don't want the scandal of killing you, but they make you leave the country. And if you come back to the country, they could put a restriction for getting out again. So there are a lot of journalists who leave the country, and they are afraid of coming back, because if they come back, they could be retained here in Cuba. That's the case of Michael Gonzalez, who is the director of Tremenda Nota, who was in the U.S., and he wanted to come back to Cuba, and he said that he was to stay here to work as a journalist, and when he tried to go out again, just for a short period of time with the intention of coming back, the government said that he was not allowed to leave the country, because that's a way of sending a message to the rest of the journalists that are abroad the country. Don't come back, because if you come back, we won't let you to go out again. And you could be here without going out, I don't know, a year, 2 years, 10 years. There's no a period of time.
What does your family think about what you do?
Well, my mother and my father, they are very supportive. I don't have kids, so that's easier for me taking this decision, because there's no bigger consequences for anyone else. And of course, my mother is worried all the time. And my father is also worried all the time. But I have prepared them. I talk with them about the risks, which, for example, when I was detained in 2016, that was a very complicated experience for my family. And I tried them to be aware that my work is not easy, but that's what makes me happy. I couldn't be any other thing. That's my reason of in life. That's my dream. That's what I am. That's what I am. And
tell me about that detention in 2016.
That was in Guantanamo, in this special place that is not like anything else in the country. And we were there. We were 9 journalists, and we went to Guantanamo to cover a hurricane, the path of a hurricane, Matthew. And we arrived the first day. It was the hurricane just had happened. We made a crowdfunding, very fast crowdfunding for internet, and we get the money. $2,000 to make a coverage with 9 people. It was like a very short amount of money for such a big coverage. And we get to Guantanamo one day, and at the next day we were all detained. It was like 48 hours, and we faced different interrogations. We went, first we were detained in Baracoa, and then they took us to a military unit. Uh-huh. In the city, in the center of the city, that is like 2 hours from Baracoa, and they kept they kept doing interviews of who we were and what we were doing there. And they make us like an advice, a letter of advice, something like that. Yeah, that at the when you have four of that, you could go to Yale.
So it's like a warning card.
A warning,
a
exactly.
yellow card in
exactly.
the game of
exactly.
how you get to jail.
Exactly. And well, that's like the what happened, but what it meant, that process for me was that I lost the confidence for doing my job. It was very fast, and I think I reacted how I could. We are not prepared for dealing with that. It was not something too dangerous, but it was humiliating because we were treated as criminal, and the women had to take off our clothes, and because they wanted to check that we didn't hide anything in our bodies, and we had to go down naked and to posh, so they realized that we didn't have anything inside us. And that was humiliating, but...
I mean, that's got to be kind of the point, right?
Yes, exactly.
Physically humiliate
It's you. Like you are not the only... You don't have rights. I can do with you whatever I want. I can put you in that position. So it's hard to recover from that. They don't... harm us in a physical way, but psychologically it was a huge impact for everybody there. Even for the magazine, it was a hard process. And I remember that we had a lot of discussions when we started blaming each other. You shouldn't be like that if that happens again. And you should have acted different. You shouldn't have said this. And we started to judge each other. And I think it was part of the trauma of living that. And it was hard as a team to overcome, to deal with that. And in an independent and personal way, for me, it took like almost a year to report again. I did my job, but I was all the time shaking, and I was very concerned, and I put myself like limits, trying to avoid a situation like that. And it was hard to recover to that.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. And I can only imagine, like, yeah, that is a difficult thing to bounce back from when, as you said at the very beginning of the interview, like, you can't do this job looking over your shoulder. Like, you have to be free somehow in your mind. And I can imagine regaining that was a challenge. Did you have some of your colleagues, some of the nine who couldn't get back into journalism?
Two of them. Yes. Two of them. Actually, one was a guy from Santiago. One of them was from Santiago de Cuba, and the other one was from Villa Clara, and he was not able of reporting again. The other one neither. And the one who was from Villa Clara is now living in the U.S. because after that, he was not able of writing anything again.
Yeah. And they detained you in Baracoa, the first city, the first village of Cuba.
Exactly.
It's like very, there's a lot of symbolic meaning. It's really fucked up that's, you know, it's many years later, that's where we are, right?
Exactly. But it's when you, it's like, I don't know if you have practiced sports. When you practice sports, you have to focus on the... I don't know, the place that you want to get when you're running or when you are swimming or something, you cannot think, oh, I'm tired, or, oh, this is happening too. You only think in your objective. And that's the same with each story. I don't want to be the story. I don't want to be in jail. I want to get the story. And for me, each story is that. It's like a competence with the state. I want to get the story, and I want to get the biggest amount of information that I can find. And I'm playing all the time with the government and to avoid them. Like if am I hiding all the time, like the heights is that name, that game, because it's easy to be detained. It's very easy to be detained. And it's each story is like a game, and you want to get the story without going to jail, without being detained, and you want to get the best story that you are capable of obtaining.
That's a hell of a game. That doesn't sound very fun at all. What kind of games are you
playing? Just focus on the story. Just on the story. Just think in the story.
For our listeners in the United States and Europe, who I hope are appropriately educated and slightly shocked by some of these stories that you're telling, like what can we do as outsiders? What would you like the world to be knowing and doing about Cuba?
I think that it's important to be aware of how it's working, the repressions and the repression on the lack of freedom in Cuba, not only because of the need that we have for solidarity, but also because what's happening here could happen in any place. And the government has been very, very good trying to avoid attention about what's happening here, because they say, well, no one dies here, and the international NGOs and organizations, they look at Cuba, no one is dying, that's fine, Mexico is worse, and of course nothing is worse than losing your life, than being killed, but the purpose of the government here is to silence you, to make you quit to your job and to maintain power. And the government has been doing that for 60 years. That's something that is very interesting to be aware of. And we were a society that before 1959, we were just like any other society in the world. We were not different. We had a dictatorship before the revolution, but still before even the dictatorship, we had a society with problems and with good things like any other society in Latin America, with a lot of problems, but we were very similar. And what happened here could happen any place. So you have to be aware how the government can control in order to maintain power, because this has destroyed generations and generations and generations. The fact that you are here talking with me and you didn't do this job 20 years before, it's not because 20 years before there was not another Monica or another journalist in my country. It's like they couldn't exist. Yeah. There was not the opportunity. So imagine how many generations we have lost.
Yep, I'm imagining. It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's all this human capital, you know, it's all the great energy and intellect of a country that's just kind of stepped on. Have you been following what's happening in the States with kind of our press problems and, you know, the sort of decline of big media and decline of trust? Do you guys look at that and, you know, get any weird feelings about it? I assume that American press freedom is something of a model for you. And now it's kind of under its own threat.
I think that not exactly American press freedom, but many media in the U.S. Of course, there are a lot of things that I admire in the American system. There are a lot of that I don't admire, of course. And
yeah, next time we'll talk, let's be in America and I can unload about all the bullshit that we do in America. Not to make it one-sided, this conversation.
But there's, I admire The New Yorker a lot. I admire Mother Jones a lot and the job that they have done regarding the prisons in the U.S. It's for me, it's amazing. ProPublica also. The Atlantic. I love to read American press, especially nonfiction. I follow a place that the name is Long Form Journalism.
Oh, then, yeah.
Yes, and I go there a lot to read what they do.
they made the mistake of putting me on their podcast once.
Yes, and...
long form is amazing.
Yes, and I read a lot of journalists from the U.S., and I think that they are doing a great job. A lot of people there are doing a great job. It's a hard work for journalism anywhere. Anywhere is hard for us. We don't receive enough money. We work with a few money, and we receive like the worst part of everything. We are accused all the time. In some countries, we are killed. People hate us. Like, we are the messengers. We only share the message. We tell what powerful people want to hide, but we are not the guilty of what's wrong. I'm not inventing the problems. I'm just telling everybody.
Amen. There you go.
Yes.
On record. But
I admire a lot of magazines and newspapers in the U.S., actually.
Good. You hear that? They need a little cheering up, I think. It's going to be a brutal season. We're going to be attacked on all sides, for sure, up to the election. So... a little bit of, yeah, encouragement and love from Cuba goes a long way. Beautiful. All right, Monica, what a pleasure to talk to you. Kind of unbelievable bravery in what you do. Thank you for doing it.
Thanks to you for telling it.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Alexa Van Sickle is our online editor. Theme music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Thank you also to Connor Gorey, the American we mentioned in the episode, who owns Cuba Libro Cafe in the Vedado neighborhood. If you can, consider donating to the cafe, which funds worthy health and education projects on the ground in Havana. I will put a link in the show notes. Next up on this feed, back to our archive episodes, released without needing a subscription for the first time. It's Chris Ying in San Francisco, a giant of food media, a writer, a producer, a podcaster from Lucky Peach to Major Domo. He drank Theraflu or something hardcore like that, and we talked about the special alchemy of food and life in the Mission District. This Thursday, we will meet you there.